It is Thursday, April 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the poisoned daughter of a former Russian spy indicates she's recovering at a British hospital.
She's thankful to the people of Britain who helped her, particularly the people of the town of Salisbury, and she hopes to be discharged soon.
President Donald Trump credits Mexico with the dispersal of a caravan of immigrants, and we hear how new gene editing tools may speed the creation of bigger harvests. It's all ahead. The poisoned daughter of a former Russian spy attacked with a nerve agent in Britain says she's recovering. Britain, the United States, and other NATO countries have expelled more than 150 Russian diplomats in a show of solidarity over the attack that critically injured Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. Russia has adamantly denied involvement and expelled an equal number of Western envoys. On Thursday, three buses believed to be carrying expelled American diplomats left the U.S. Embassy in Moscow after their luggage was loaded on trucks. Jamie Detmer, recently in Moscow, describes what is known about Yulia Skripal's improving condition.
She's communicated with a cousin, Victoria Skripal, who's in Moscow and is planning to fly in the next day or two to London. And she also communicated with the Metropolitan Police, who put out a statement on her behalf saying that she has improved, that she's strengthening every day. She's thankful to the people of Britain who helped her, particularly the people of the town of Salisbury, and she hopes to be discharged soon, which is a remarkable turnaround because a month ago the suggestion was that they might never recover, and if they did, they wouldn't recover their full faculties. We don't know much about the father, though. She didn't mention in the statement to the police the condition of the father. The hospital in Salisbury hasn't updated for several days from what they said a few days ago, was that he was critical but stable, although Victoria has said that he apparently is improving as well. But we take a little bit of pinch of salt what Victoria says.
Now, meanwhile, however, the British government is facing questions about possibly whether they overstated the case, blaming Moscow for that nerve agent attack that so hurt the Skripals.
They seem to have made some missteps. They're not backing away from saying it was the Russian state, but originally their claims were based on a pattern of Russian behavior, aggressive behavior the last few years, including some very odd and strange death of Putin critics on British soil, as well as intent, motive, and capability. But 2 weeks ago, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson was saying that Porton Down, the defense facility, Britain's defense facility, had actually established that it had definitely produced this nerve agent, Novichok, had been produced in Russia. But this week, the head of the laboratory said, in fact, that they could confirm it was a Soviet-developed agent. They had not been able to establish, and would never be able to fully establish, that it was actually produced in Russia. So, of course, the Russian officials, the Kremlin, the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, have absolutely swooped down on this and are making great hay out of it on social media and in press conferences. And it has rather embarrassed the British. They, you know, have some awkward questions of their own to answer, and they've been pushed a little bit on the defensive.
But certainly there have been a number, in addition to this case involving the Skripals, there have been a number of, as you were saying, mysterious, strange deaths of Russians within the UK in the last few years.
Absolutely, up to about a dozen in the last decade, including the assassination of another former Russian agent, Litvinenko, who was poisoned with polonium, polonium-101, and the killers left a trail all the way back to Moscow because they found polonium on the aircraft that they had used to fly back to Moscow. Look, there's an information war going on, and there are doubters and there are allies of Russia who want complete evidence as though this is a course of law. And in this information war, which is being fought, you know, furiously by the British and the Russians, if you make missteps like they have, the British have in the last week or two, then you are rather forced on the defensive.
Reporter Jamie Detmer. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, what's trending is social media, specifically Facebook, and a new verb that Mark Zuckerberg introduced yesterday called scraping. What he announced yesterday and what Facebook announced on Wednesday is that upward of 2 billion users of Facebook worldwide have had their accounts, quote, scraped by malicious actors. That means people who are up to no good, who are searching for specific information that might then possibly be used to infiltrate people's bank accounts or other kinds of nefarious activities. Upwards of 2 billion people have had their accounts. That's pretty much everybody who's on Facebook.
Wow.
And they really have egg on face. They also have announced yesterday that we've been hearing about Cambridge Analytica, the company that the Trump campaign had used during the 2016 election to gather information, that Cambridge Analytica essentially stole, illegally accessed private information, personal information from about 87 million people. That's much higher than was reported before. 71 million of them were Americans. So clearly Americans were being targeted by Cambridge Analytica. Basically, this has Facebook stock plummeting down about 8% just in the last week or two. Mark Zuckerberg is going to be testifying next week, one day before the House Commerce Committee, I believe, and the next day a joint session of the Senate Commerce and Justice Committee. So he's going to have quite a go. He's going to be facing a lot of intense questioning about whether Facebook is and has been doing everything that it says it is to protect users' private information.
Mm, quite a development. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The two Koreas hold preparatory talks ahead of their landmark summit. More U.S. teachers walk out for higher pay and better education. Pakistan's prime minister will visit Kabul, Afghanistan to discuss peace in Afghanistan and mutual ties. And Facebook says Cambridge Analytica gathered data on 87 million users. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The 2016 discovery of the most distant star ever seen, so far, has been outlined in a new study published by the journal Nature Astronomy. According to the study, the star, nicknamed Icarus, is located about 9 billion light years from Earth. This means light from the star started travels toward Earth about 4.7 billion years after the Big Bang. An international group of astronomers say the discovery was made possible by using an optical phenomenon called gravitational lensing. Gravitational lensing is caused when a massive object like a galaxy, galaxy cluster, or black hole is in front of a more distant and dimmer object. Gravity from the closer object bends the light of the one further behind, providing a magnification normally of up to 50 times. The study says the gravitational magnification in this instance was more than 2,000 times. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about the struggles of a 12-year-old bomb survivor in Afghanistan. U.S. President Donald Trump credited the Mexican legal system Thursday for dispersing a caravan of Central American migrants making its way north through Mexico, with some headed for the U.S. Mr. Trump praised his administration for a dramatic drop in the number of immigrants crossing the southwest border. From his Twitter account, Trump credits the strong immigration laws of Mexico with breaking up the caravan, saying his administration had kept border crossings at a 46-year low, though he thought the current level was still unacceptable. Mexican officials said the caravan has begun to disperse, but some participants said they're going to continue. Mexico's foreign ministry warned against the militarization of the border, saying it could harm bilateral relations. It's Duncan Wood heads the Mexico Center at the Washington-based Wilson Institute. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, some Mexican officials see this as a bargaining tactic in the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, as well as a signal for Mexico to do more to stem the flow of Central Americans northward to the U.S.
But I think Mexicans are also quite aware of the domestic political dimension of this move by President Trump. They understand that he's trying to appeal to his base. He's already in campaign mode for the 2020 election. And they see this as being just another wild card move on the part of the American president, which unfortunately has left them in the crosshairs.
This is also impacting the Mexican presidential campaign.
Yes, the campaign kicked off last Friday. Up until this point, there's been very little anti-American sentiment that's come to the surface. But now that this move has taken place, all of the major candidates are going to have to make statements reacting to it. And so far, it's been relatively moderate. We've seen candidates coming forward and saying that they will demand mutual respect in the relationship. But, you know, there's the temptation always when you're in campaign mode to try to do a little bit, engage in a little bit of one-upmanship over your rivals. And so you could see that it's very easy for one of the candidates to begin to use anti-American rhetoric, or at least anti-Trump rhetoric in their campaigns.
Were you surprised at the length the president went to on Tuesday at a joint briefing with the Baltic heads of state about this so-called caravan moving from Honduras or Central America north through Mexico?
Yes, I mean, I think, first of all, it shows a lack of understanding of what is actually happening with this caravan, because, of course, there are genuine refugees and migrants who are coming up from Honduras, but it's also a civil society effort in Mexico that occurs every year to try to highlight the plight of refugees as they move through Mexico. And the caravan itself will end in central Mexico. The migrants and the refugees will continue onwards, but it's not as though this is going to be a well-coordinated effort as they move towards the U.S. border. The length that he went to explain his reaction, I think, shows that, once again, President Trump has made a bold statement through his Twitter feed and is now desperately trying to fill in the gaps in terms of a policy or a strategy here. The decision to send the National Guard to the border is something which, you know, in my opinion, is excessive. But, you know, we have to think about what the border governors themselves have said. And we've seen that Governors Ducey, Martinez, and Abbott have already said that they support the move. So this is something that is likely to happen. It's not the first time it's happened in history. But, you know, when it's happened in the past, you have to say that the conditions on the southwest border were radically different. You know, back in 2000, there was 1.65 million undocumented migrants crossing the border on an annual basis. Today, it's only 300,000.
And Duncan Wood said that number continues to decline. He said it's due partly to a more difficult climate for illegal immigrants at the border and seeking work in the U.S., tougher Mexican enforcement. He said many Central Americans have found work in Mexico, while even in countries like Honduras, economic growth in Central America is on the rise. A group that monitors landmines says more than 25,000 people have been killed or injured in landmine accidents in Afghanistan since 1978. An Afghan expert on unexploded ordnances told VOA he has made it his life's mission to defuse the deadly devices before they maim and kill. But as VOA's Azula Popal and Zabihullah Ghazi found out in this report from Afghanistan, Siraj Ahmad Afghanmal can't save everyone from the terrible consequences of a landmine explosion. Shaista Sadat Lami narrates their story.
This is the district center of Panjwai, west of Kandahar city. Siraj Ahmad Afghanmal is busy clearing roadside mines in a Taliban-held area recently recaptured by government forces.
It does not require a battery, charger, or anything else. When a vehicle passes over it, it explodes and causes destruction.
Afghanmal has disabled over 10,000 explosive devices. As one of his country's top demining experts, he is believed to have saved thousands of lives. Afwanmal is aware of the dangers of his job. His colleague, Bahadur Khan, was killed in a mine blast 2 months ago while clearing mines in Taliban-held territory. Afwanmal has survived his share of close calls. But 12-year-old Nurzia was not as lucky. Just a few hundred kilometers from where Afwanmal was defusing landmines, Nurzia stepped on a landmine near her home in Nangarhar province.
It was 8 in the morning when my mother sent me out to collect twigs for cooking. I was reluctant to go on that day, but I went to get rid of boredom at home. I lost both my legs when a mine exploded.
An international charity fitted Nurzia with artificial limbs, enabling her to walk and provide support to her parents and her extended family. But she regrets she can no longer go to school, which makes her bitter towards those who plant landmines.
I ask them why they cause suffering to people. May God get angry with those who lay bombs and hurt or kill civilians.
Each day, her father helps attach her artificial limbs, one leg at a time. Nurzia dreams of being a doctor someday, but says her dreams are on hold right now. For Azizullah Popal in Kandahar and Zabihullah Ghazi in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, this is Shaista Sadatlami, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Feeding the world depends on bountiful harvests, even in the face of changing pests and climate. Scientists are bringing a new tool to the effort, a bacterial gene editing system called CRISPR. The technique works like a molecular pair of scissors that targets a specific location in the DNA. From Berkeley, California, Shelley Schlendler reports that CRISPR is speeding the creation of more pest-resistant crops, including those essential for bread and chocolate.
Wheat provides more calories for people than any other plant, for instance, in bread. As for chocolate, at the Diablo Farmers Market near Berkeley, California, the artisan chocolate stand is so popular.
Oh my gosh. Oh, nice and silky smooth.
Oh, I'm glad you like them.
It confirms the saying that 9 out of 10 people like chocolate. And the 10th person always lies.
My sweet treat.
Wait till you try the truffle.
But pests also like food crops. To keep them at bay, scientists at the Innovative Genomics Institute are using high-tech equipment to harness a recently discovered bacterial gene editing system called CRISPR. Bacteria use it to snip out viral infections in their DNA. The lab's managing director, Susan Jenkins, says they are using CRISPR to snip plant DNA.
So what CRISPR is going to allow is for us to go in, make these changes, and then within one generation of the plant, actually have the trait we want incorporated.
Already, the Institute's scientists have used this method to develop a wheat variety that resists a fungal rust that can reduce yields by nearly 50%. To do this, the scientists used CRISPR to snip out a specific gene that was making the wheat vulnerable to rust.
So in this case, we use CRISPR to actually knock out a gene that's in the wheat.
While CRISPR speeds up plant breeding, Jenkins says it's not a magic wand. Changing a plant still takes a lot of steps. For wheat, the scientists had to figure out just which gene was making it vulnerable to fungal rust. they used CRISPR to remove that gene. Plant transformation expert Myung J. Cho says they started small.
Basically, the single cell is transformed, right?
In the lab, they grew single gene-edited wheat cells into wheat clones for further testing. In just over a year, some clones are now stalks of wheat.
We have grown out plants in the greenhouse.
In the Institute's greenhouse, Cho shows gallon-sized pots of healthy, CRISPRed wheat, complete with normal stalks and robust seed heads. And all of this was done in just over 1 year. While no foreign genetic material is introduced in the wheat through the CRISPR process, the technology does allow scientists to add genes from other species, as is done with GMO crops. Institute scientists want to use CRISPR to fight the swollen shoot virus that's attacking cacao trees in West Africa. The virus evolved in other plants, then, half a century ago, jumped species to cacao trees, which it can kill in just 3 years. So the Institute is working to add virus resistance to cacao tree DNA by adding a resistance gene from bacteria.
If the bacteria have already evolved this to fight the viral infection, we're just going to take that mechanism and put it directly into the plant.
The team plans to start growing cacao trees resistant to swollen shoot virus within a year. That is fast, according to Institute Science Director Brian Staskowitz.
What this technology can do is it can allow us to work with the elite cultivars of a plant and to basically change them either for drought resistance or maybe cold tolerance and disease resistance in a more rapid fashion than just classical plant breeding.
Staskowitz says it's an exciting project from a technical standpoint because cacao plants are unusually difficult to clone and genetically transform.
This is a variety pack. It has one single origin, dark chocolate.
At the Diablo Farmers Market, chocolatier Eli Curtis suspects we could also increase cocoa yields by helping farmers be better stewards of wild cacao trees. He's not sure consumers will like the idea of gene-edited chocolate, but if CRISPR leads to more pest-resistant crops.
And definitely understand the value, and I also understand specifically consumers' apprehension.
Nevertheless, Staskowitz says we need faster plant breeding techniques like CRISPR because we are in a race.
You know, we're currently 7.9 billion people on the Earth. By 2050, there's going to be 9 billion, and the estimates are that we actually need to increase food production by 70%. So we're going to need a way to actually increase the yield of these plants to feed the population of the world.
He and his team hope within a decade, CRISPRed crops may be ingredients for many things, including bread and chocolate. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Berkeley, California.
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The UN Security Council's 1718 North Korea Sanctions Committee unanimously approved 49 new UN designations, 21 shipping companies, one individual, and 27 ships, all aimed at countering North Korea's illegal maritime smuggling activities to obtain oil and sell coal and preventing certain entities and ships from aiding them in these efforts. These new designations were proposed in February by the U.S. mission to coincide with the announcement of the U.S. Treasury Department's largest ever North Korea sanctions package and are part of a coordinated effort to continue the maximum pressure campaign on the North Korean regime and systematically shut down its maritime smuggling activities. The U.S. Department of Treasury is aggressively targeting all illicit avenues used by North Korea to evade sanctions, including taking decisive action to block the vessels, shipping companies, and entities across the globe that work on North Korea's behalf, said Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. These sanctions, he said, will significantly hinder the Kim regime's capacity to conduct evasive maritime activities that facilitate illicit coal and fuel transports and erode its abilities to ship goods through international waters. President Donald Trump has made it clear to companies worldwide that if they choose to help fund North Korea's nuclear ambitions, they will not do business with the United States. The U.S. thanks its partners and allies for lending their support to these sanctions. It is a clear sign that the international community is united in its efforts to keep up maximum pressure on the North Korean regime, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley. We want to thank the members of the Security Council, as well as Japan and South Korea, for working with us to keep up the pressure and for their commitment to implementing UN Security Council resolutions and holding violators accountable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.